Welcome back to my series on morality. This is part 7, medical ethics. If you've been following along, the first 5 focused on moral principles through which we will continue to discuss them in these last 3 sessions. And these last 4, the last one in these next 3, are all about applying those particular principles to real world issues. Today's topic being medical ethics. Before we jump into the practical side of medical ethics, I want to start out by giving a broad overview of where medical technology has been. Because the advances in medical technology we've made over the last 100 years has radically reshaped the way we think of medical ethics, and in a very important way, how we understand healthcare and how we work within the healthcare system. So let's go back. Let's go back 100 years. 100 years ago, we didn't think about calling a doctor. If it was something we couldn't deal with, we would just summon the doctor, he would come over to the house, and then we'd pay him a little bit of money for maybe a medicine or a checkup, and that's how things worked. That was the extent of medical technology. Whatever drugs or procedures they had developed, that's what we got. But largely, people didn't go to a doctor's office, we didn't go to a hospital, we didn't go to some special clinic. People of the early 1900s and earlier would simply find a doctor, pay a small amount, and then whatever the doctor could do, the doctor did. The sharp contrast between then and here cannot be understated. Today, people fear the costs of medical care more than the actual issue of calling a doctor. The fact of going to a doctor's office or going to a hospital or going to a care facility worries people because of expenses. Medical costs have become so incredibly expensive compared to where they were 100 years ago. In a similar way, 100 years ago, simple things like pneumonia or a common infection would be almost fatal. Today, because of the advances of medical technology, most of what was considered fatal 100 years ago is common and easily curable, like infections, pneumonia, most forms of waterborne pathogens, most forms of pathogens in general can be treated by medical technology. Another one that we don't think about is 100 years ago, the vast majority of people died in their homes. As someone got older and end of life seemed to be pressing upon them, they would be confined to their home or confined to their bed where family would take care of them till the final breath was extinguished. Today, however, most people die in hospitals. Since end-of-life care tends to be very expensive and very specific, people would be needing various forms of technology like respirators or heart monitors. They would be in care facilities where they would have specialized care during their end-of-life. And therefore, today, most people die in hospitals. Even this small little overview of the differences between medical technology 100 years ago and medical technology today already makes clear how vastly different our ethical decisions are and how different our medical decisions are. We live in a very different age, an age of very challenging issues. And we'll get to those right now. The first one, I bring it up mainly because of the controversies that surrounded it, would be vaccines. Vaccines are not immoral on their own. Vaccines are largely a form of medical technology that can be used to prevent or to hinder the spread of a disease within someone's body. Vaccines have been around for quite a while, and for the most part, they're not an issue. Most colleges and especially schools require certain levels of vaccines in order to participate in the functioning of the classroom. The issue around this is not so much vaccines. The issue is the COVID vaccine. And the reason why I bring this up is because through the issues involved with the COVID vaccine, I can explain moral principles and show you how medical technology has changed our view of medicine in general. Before we head into COVID as a issue of its own, I want to compare it to a similar vaccine, or at least similar in the way the church presented it, from 2005. When the mumps, rubella, and meningococcal vaccine came out, a similar issue developed and the Catholic Church responded to it. In their decision based on the issues of mumps, rubella, and meningococcal as a vaccine, the Church made the following statement. This particular vaccine was produced using aborted stem cells. So in the 1970s, a series of abortions were performed, and those cells from the abortions have been cultivated throughout the decades leading to the modern era. These cell lines are used for the production of vaccines in that either the vaccine is tested on it, such as COVID, or it's inserted into an aborted fetal cell that is infected with the virus to see how the cell responds, or it's produced from it, like mumps, rubella, and meningococcal. So the church made a statement. Is it morally licit for a person to take the mumps rubella vaccine given the fact that it was made with aborted fetal cell material? If you recall back a long ways, we're going to use the principle of cooperation. How morally culpable am I for taking this vaccine given the fact that it's connected with the evil act of abortion? Here's how it goes. So I am not a doctor. I did not kill the fetus itself. Therefore, I'm not formally responsible for the act of abortion. If I were a medical practitioner who dealt with the vaccine and the production of the vaccine using those aborted fetal cells, I am more culpable since I informally cooperate with the act of abortion. Without those aborted stem cells, I could not make the vaccine. But what about me, the consumer, who is taking a vaccine? I neither performed the abortion, nor did I use the aborted fetal cells for what I'm doing. For that reason, the church declared that when mumps rubella, I am far enough removed from the act of abortion, hence remote or remotely cooperating with it, that I'm no longer morally culpable for the act of abortion. Therefore, the church declared that because this vaccine is useful for the treatment of these diseases, it is also a moral choice for someone to take the vaccine. That being said, the church had a second statement she made in the midst of this declaration. So the first one was, for people who see this as medically necessary or medically important, they can make a moral decision to take the vaccine. Secondarily, if someone has a strong moral objection to abortion, the church recommends they not take the vaccine and encourage lawmakers and those in policy making to encourage medical people to not use aborted fetal cells for the sake of medical practices. So there's those two contrasts, which I found fascinating when I read the article, that it is morally licit to do either. Someone could choose for or against the vaccine and make a moral claim for it, but ultimately the goal is to encourage medical people to stop using aborted fetal cells so we stop the act of abortion. Let's fast forward to COVID. So we go ahead almost 20 years, to the debate with COVID. The church did not produce quite the same document as it did with mumps and rubella. Instead, with the COVID vaccine, the church just blanketly declared the same thing they did with mumps and rubella. This is an important health crisis on a global level. The COVID vaccine was not made using aborted fetal cells, but mainly tested with them, and therefore there are no aborted fetal cells in the COVID vaccine. A person can morally choose to take it and morally choose not to based on their own conscience. Yeah, when we actually boil down this issue, it's kind of boring. If you're interested in going further with this, you can read the document the church produced on mumps and rubella. I just Google searched mumps rubella the Catholic Church and found it. The actual website is www.immunize.org/talking-about-vaccines/vatican-document.html. This document can explain it even further detail, including the medical side behind it. Ultimately, the question is, how morally complicit am I with the act of abortion by taking the vaccine? Using the principle of cooperation, I am remotely cooperating with the act of abortion by taking the vaccine, and therefore, by the level of remoteness, I am not morally responsible for the act of abortion. Okay, let's go into a happier topic, euthanasia. I hope you got my pun. Euthanasia. Euthanasia is usually hidden under a lot of different guises. We use lots of language to describe the same thing, even though they are not technically related. Like death with dignity, right to live well, end of suffering, not prolonging suffering, respecting a person's wishes, population control, disease prevention, and genocide. All of these phrases or statements or social cues, depending on how you want to call it, all state the same thing. They're all ways of describing euthanasia. That's why we have to be careful in that we describe well what the action is, what the intention is, and how that affects what I am doing. So let's start with a simpler situation, and we'll move into more complicated ones. The first situation is euthanasia for terminal cases. This is the most commonly used form of euthanasia. Someone who is terminally ill. They have cancer, they have a serious disease, they are just super ill, super old, whatever it might be, may decide that the suffering they endure in this life is so great that it's better off if they just peacefully go. Do you hear my language? We can use things in this category like death with dignity. Instead of having to go through the torments of the disease or the effects of the drugs or watching someone wither away to nothing, we let them die dignified. Hence, we give them a lethal dose of morphine. We can also say the right to live well. When someone's at the end of their life and they decide that the rest of their life will not be worth it or they will not gain anything more from it, then they have lived well and they would like to end it here. The last one that's very common is the end of suffering. When someone is in a serious medical situation, suffering is a very common experience. Many medical practitioners and even family members may argue that if we give them something, lethal dose of morphine, then their suffering goes away and they don't have to suffer anymore. How nice and charitable. Well, let's describe this in greater detail. What are we doing? In all the situations I mentioned before, it's the same action. We are heightening the speed of death, and in many cases, making it happen right then and there. The most common form is a lethal dose of morphine. Morphine's a tough one, because in many cases, morphine is used for the sake of alleviating pain, and that's what it's meant for. At that point, it would be morally licit to do so. Why should someone have to suffer? The next effect of morphine is when enough morphine enters the body, it causes the muscles around the heart to relax and the muscles around the lungs to relax, so the person stops breathing and their heart stops beating, hence they die. So there's this fine line between giving enough morphine to ease the pain and giving so much that it causes the death of the person. That's the moral challenge that we have. It is morally licit to give morphine with the intention of alleviating suffering. It is not morally licit to give morphine for the sake of ending their suffering or ending their life. That's where we have to be careful with intention. It's a lot more complicated than it sounds. In Seattle, they have a concoction, I forget what they call it, in which it's a series of drugs that they give someone and they tell the family this is going to end their suffering. Many of the nurses know this, and they just give it and it kills the patient. They know that. It's another form of euthanasia. Regardless of the situation, we are never morally allowed to kill a person. Even if it means alleviating their suffering, even if it means causing them to live well or to die well, we're never allowed to do that. We are always allowed to alleviate someone's suffering as much as we can without killing them. So there's a fine line. There's a challenge we have. In cases where people are terminal, what can we do to alleviate their suffering without killing them? Or what line did we cross in saying, actually, that was giving them a lethal dose of something? Here's the second one, very closely associated with the first one. Euthanasia is advancing beyond end-of-life care. People are now seeing this as a means to end life in general. They're not terminally ill. They don't have some serious issue. There's no suffering that causes this beyond maybe mental. And now we see it in many different categories. There's a doctor on the East Coast that developed a pod for killing people. It's called the euthanasia pod. Basically, he wants to set them up on every street corner, so if somebody wants to die, they just hop in the pod, the machine does its work, and the body disappears. There's other ways to use the same basic language, and this is where it gets challenging. In various ways, we think of people as either with chronic conditions, mental disorders, physical ailments, or use a language as non-productive members of society. This kind of language is becoming more common, where instead of just seeing terminal patients or elderly patients as those seeking euthanasia, we're now starting to think of people who are non-productive as deserving to die. Man, that sounded harsh. Or people with chronic illnesses as a drain on society, so they're better off dead. This kind of language is becoming more common. A good example of this comes from Iceland. In 2016, Iceland declared Down syndrome illegal. And so any baby who tests positive for Down syndrome is immediately aborted. You think that might be strange for Iceland. Just a few years after that, in 2018, Great Britain followed suit, and now they also outlawed Down syndrome. In the United States, mothers who are preparing to have their child can ask for a genetic test for Down syndrome and various other genetic disorders. If any of the genetic disorders come up, they have grounds for aborting their child. We are very much so in an age where we're starting to see quality of life as the goal. If someone has a genetic disorder, their quality cannot match those that don't have it, so we'll just get rid of them. We'll just wean that gene out of the pool. We'll come back to this one in a little bit later. The last side of euthanasia, which is becoming increasingly common globally, is population control and genocide. In a lot of biological circles, the idea of population control is becoming more common. The underlying foundation behind that is that we are becoming too populous as a race on the globe. Eventually, we'll reach a cap in which we have too many people, and therefore the environment cannot sustain that many people. At one point, when I was in college, the number was set at 7 billion. We are clearly past 7 billion. Now it's set at 10 billion. We are closely approaching the 10 billion mark, and depending on who you ask, it can be as high as 20 billion. The ultimate problem is, when we talk about population control, we don't know what the cap is for the planet. And there's a lot of other issues underlying it that I want to bring to your attention. When you talk about population control, we talk about a lot of assumptions to which we cannot justify. One of them is that the world can only sustain so much. That is true. The world can only sustain so much, but what does that look like? Does that mean that each family has their own acre of land and whatever they can produce on that one acre is what's considered sustainable? Is it mass production of stuff? Is it how much we can mass produce food given the amount of land that we have? The challenges we have when we talk about use of land is that our technology keeps advancing and it makes our use of land even greater. For example, about a decade ago in Colorado, this company developed a food elevator. It takes up half a city block and it's 4 stories tall, and it's this elevator that the crops slowly rotate up and down the elevator and they grow. In these facilities, these greenhouses, they can produce 40,000 pounds of herbs, 40,000 pounds of lettuce, 20,000 pounds of tomatoes, and various other types of vegetables. That's a huge amount for half an acre. Not even half a block. That vastly increases the amount of food we can have. The other issue that underlies population control is it assumes that we're going to live the same way we are now. An American living in any city in America uses far more resources than anyone living in Mesoamerica, than anyone living in many parts of the world. We have a lot of resources at our disposal, and the amount of resources we use is directly related to how high that population cap is. So when we talk about population control, we have to be careful. Is it really related to a physical reality, or is it how we see ourselves and our unwillingness to change? If we were to change common practices, would that cap increase? Genocide is becoming more common. We saw that with the Nazi Germany side of things, but we're starting to see that more commonly with genetic disorders as well, trying to weed them out of society or trying to kill people who are not as productive as we want them to be. Even places like China, for a long time with their one-child rule, many girls were killed because that would not pass on the family line. Genocide is far more common today than we realize. And although these things may seem sci-fi in nature, they are not. The issue of euthanasia is very common today, and common enough where it's worth paying attention to. What do we mean by quality of life? What do we mean by life in general? Do we care about life? Does life matter? Or is it just a fleeting concept through which we have our existence and then move on? These are the challenges we have to discuss. If life is important, then euthanasia is a problem. If life is not important, then nothing is. The last topic under medical ethics is healthcare. Healthcare is a very serious issue today. Not only does it affect the quality of life of people, it also affects them economically. Healthcare is immensely expensive. Some of those drugs out there can range between $14,000 and $30,000 a dose, and things like chemotherapy can cost thousands upon thousands of dollars, if not up to $1 million. How do people afford this? So this is the question. This is a very important question. Is healthcare a right, or is healthcare a privilege? For those who say healthcare is a privilege, they also support privatization of healthcare, that those who are economically astute and have the money to do with it, then they can have the healthcare that they need. Those who claim that healthcare is a right claim that healthcare should be socialized so that everyone has access to it. The question is actually much more complicated. The question devolves around what we want from our healthcare system. So let's start here. Everyone agrees that healthcare is important. Regardless of whether you think of privatization or universalization of healthcare, healthcare is still important. The health and well-being of people directly relates to the good of society. The better the health of people, the more productive they can be. The more we support people's health and allow them to recover and live well, the more they can promote the good of the people, of all peoples. So in that way, healthcare is a basic human need. We need to be healthy. We need to be well. What does that look like? So let's start with this, the universalization of healthcare. What would that do? So the universalization of healthcare would provide the basic right for all people to have basic medical care. Various things like broken bones, cuts, bruises, various diseases can be healed fairly simply through basic medical care. So in that way, by having universalization of healthcare, all people will be able to strive for the good, be able to promote their well-being and their livelihood, and be able to feel good about life. That being said, there are economic challenges to both universal healthcare and privatization. The universalization of healthcare poses the serious economic challenge of funding it. Where does it come from? If everyone has a right and nobody pays for it, clearly the system's going to be broken. That's one of the joys of privatization of healthcare. We know where the money comes from. It comes from the people who come for medical care. Therefore, the sicker you are, the more you pay. Kind of what it comes down to. But there's more to it than that. When we see the larger system of healthcare, the actual costs of medical care come from the advances we've made. Because we continue to develop more drugs and better techniques, because our ability to care for people and to provide for any kind of medical issue continues to increase, so does cost. Cost is directly related to how good our healthcare is. The more advanced our techniques, the more expensive they are. The better our drugs, the more expensive they are. We can't avoid that. And so in that way, we have to be clear about economic challenges. Although a universalization of healthcare seems like a good idea, and is also a great good for many people, we have to figure out how that's funded and how that would change our system. Would we lose a lot of the progress we make in advances in medical technology? Or can we find a way to continue those advances but see things better? See a way to provide for medical good and advancement at the same time. The same thing works with the privatization of healthcare. If we privatize it, clearly we know where the money comes from. But does that ensure the good for all people? Is it only the rich who can provide, who can get the medical care they want and the procedures they need? Or should all people have access to those? When we also talk about healthcare, we also have to talk about the ends of healthcare. What is it designed for? Is it designed for simple procedures and basic needs, or is it for normalization? I argue that healthcare today, its end is the normalization of all peoples. There's a certain way of living that we want to cultivate and support. We want to normalize all people so that all diseases are cured, no one suffers, and there's no issues medically. This reminds me of a Doctor Who episode in which they find this planet where they have found a cure to every disease, so no one has sickness ever again. Is that our goal? Is that the end that we strive for medical technology, that we have eliminated all things? You may think it's strange, but I argue this is how most doctors think. In a clinical perspective, their goal is to treat the disease and make it go away. I argue a better end for healthcare is for the functioning of the individual. This means that we don't have a collective norm to which we seek, but instead, each individual person is judged by their own desires. What is normal for me? What do I strive for? What is good enough? What can I live with? How can I recognize my own health challenges, but also live a good, full life? If we really were honest about the ends of healthcare, we'd look not towards normalization, but quality of life, which is the last topic for this series, this section. Quality of life. What am I striving for? Immortality? Am I striving for basic functioning? Am I striving to live? What am I striving for? I argue quality of life is that topic. How do I want to live, and how do I want to live well? So I hope you see that in the challenges of healthcare, there's a lot of factors that influence it, not just the economic ones we're used to, but also the rights of people. In the same vein, we also look at how healthcare affects us. Do I want it to promote a certain way of living? Do I want to be able to choose my own healthcare? A good example of what I mean comes from a TED talk on medical marijuana. This guy gave a case in which he advocated for the use of medical marijuana, but his points were strange. He said, "There is no scientific evidence to suggest that medical marijuana is actually useful, that it alleviates pain. But," he said, "he is an advocate for it because it allows people to have some level of autonomy over their health care. Today, most people who go to the doctor's office are given a pill and said, do this. Take it, whatever is required for the medicine. They have no choice in dosage. They have no choice in how often they take it. They have actually almost no choice in what medication they choose. The doctor makes all those choices. With medical marijuana, when someone chooses that route, someone comes to their house or their room, tells them about the different types, tells them how to choose doses, tells them how to have autonomy over their health care. That is a good. And he makes a point that we need to pay attention to. We don't have as much autonomy in health care as we wish. And having autonomy lets us choose the quality of our life, what we ought to do. Therefore, we need to re-envision what health care looks like. What do we want from it? And when we start to have these conversations, when we start to dialogue about the good, what we seek, what it means to be human, what it means to live and live well, then we can develop a system based on that that helps us recognize what healthcare looks like and how we ought to promote it in our society.